This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Chicken noodle soup.
Minestrone soup.
I like the clam chowder one.
Asparagus.
Cream of mushroom and all that.
It's got to be tomato.
We're not at the grocery store. We're at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City looking at some of Andy Warhol's Campbell soup can paintings. I'll bet there's nothing in all of American art more famous than those soup cans. Even if people can't say for sure who painted, say, American Gothic, they probably know that Andy Warhol did the soup cans. Warhol's influence is now so pervasive we usually take it for granted. But today we are exploring how he changed our culture forever. And there's no better place to begin than with those cans. As part of our series on American icons, we sent Studio 360's David Krasnow to find out how that familiar old red and white label got turned into art.
There are 32 soup cans on the wall at MoMA because there were 32 varieties of Campbell's soup when Warhol painted them. 32 varieties, 32 paintings. Pretty straightforward. Except that nobody in the history of painting had ever thought to paint a can of soup before. Nobody. And why would they have? Why paint a can of soup?
The honest answer for me is that he really loved America.
Sing a song of soup since Campbell's goes to school.
And he loved what America's made available.
Pack a vacuum bottle of good hot Campbell's soup in every lunchbox.
He painted refrigerators with a turkey, and he painted washing machines and all these things that meant a lot to a family like his.
It would be the equivalent now of doing a portrait of a balance bar or a Luna bar. You know, it's fake food.
To take a banal subject and to elevate it to a profound degree is no mean trick.
It's a still life of the 60s, American industrial still life, because inside is contained onion, rice, barley, pepper, leeks, turnip.
That's what Campbell's soups are.
The word can is slang for ass. So there is a sense that the can was, for Andy, rough trade. You know, like a sailor.
Maybe we better slow down here. This is Wayne Kustenbaum, a poet who wrote a biography of Warhol.
The drawings that he was most known for in the 50s were these I. Miller women's shoes, and there is nothing more swish than drawings of women's shoes. The can itself is hard, matte, unexpressive, kind of masculine.
In the late 50s, a young furniture salesman named Irving Blum decided to go into the art business. He became a partner at a new gallery called Ferris in Los Angeles. So he would take trips to New York to look for new artists, and he kept hearing about a guy named Andy Warhol.
He was doing these big, unfinished cartoon paintings.
Blum went back in 1962 to offer Andy his first solo show.
I walked into his little house again, and there were these Campbell soup paintings on the floor, and I said, "What happened to the cartoons you were doing?" He said, I went to visit Leo Castelli, and there's somebody else, I can't remember his name, doing these cartoon pictures, doing them better than I was doing them.
Roy Lichtenstein had scooped Andy. So just like that, Andy gave up painting comics and started painting what he had for lunch every day.
Well, that's what the legend says, but there's a lot of legend about Warhol.
Ultraviolet was one of Andy's main collaborators in the 60s, and she may have given him the idea to paint soup cans.
There was a coffee shop in my building, and I remember sitting next to him, and he said one day, "What shall I do? What shall I paint?" And I said, "Well, you know, what's in front of you, whatever you eat, Campbell can soup."
But a lot of Andy's friends tell a similar story.
You see, what he used to do is, like, ask a lot of questions and get a common denominator. He would ask everybody. And if maybe 10 people would say, "Oh, you should paint a dollar sign," then he would do it.
Andy gave his oldest brother's family one of his early soup cans, a can of pepper pot. Here's his nephew, James Warhola.
As kids, we would take it to school and show it to the teachers and the other students. We put it in a paper bag. And it was, since it was not a large painting, we could kind of probably carry my lunchbox in one hand and the painting in the other.
But Irving Blum knew all along the paintings were something special.
Coming into the gallery day after day, you know, they just set me thinking about what people, say, for example, in 100 years, would think about those paintings.
Blum bought the whole group from Andy, paying him $100 a month for 10 months. And people thought he'd been taken for a fool, like the guy who owned the gallery just a few doors down the block.
He put a stack of Campbell soup cans that he had bought at the local supermarket in his window and a big sign, "Buy them more cheaply here, 2 for 32 cents.
But Warhol knew that all publicity is good publicity.
He was mentioned in Time magazine, and I think in the family we were all kind of excited because we had an uncle that was mentioned in Time magazine. That he was kind of on the cutting edge of a new art form or something.
Or something.
Nobody called it pop. There was no name. As a matter of fact, Ivan Carr dubbed the style communism. And happily, that name didn't stick.
If most people took the new pop art as a kind of joke, which maybe it was, the painting establishment was not laughing. Arthur Danto is a philosopher and art critic.
I'm not sure I've got the anecdote totally right, but he was at a party in East Hampton, and de Kooning was there, and de Kooning was drunk. And he said, "I hate you." He said, "You've destroyed art." He said, "You've destroyed beauty. You've destroyed laughter." And that was the end of it.
Abstract artists like de Kooning and Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Lee Krasner, they believed in painting. They reached deep into their souls and wrenched out these dramatic explosions onto the canvas that represented, well, something. You could never say for sure, but sure as hell not a can of soup.
It seems a moment of a great sigh of relief that a certain ponderousness and pompousness of 1950s American art is finally over.
Wayne Kustenbaum, the Warhol biographer.
And that a know-nothing, swishy, pale, really profoundly inarticulate guy like Andy Warhol can change art history. One could say it's like Reagan becoming president, but I don't feel that way about it at all. Nonetheless, one could say that Andy Warhol's arrival as a kind of faux artist and being confused with a real artist was like this weird phenomenon of a fool like Reagan or Arnold Schwarzenegger being taken for a politician, that there's something kind of funny on the conceptual level about it, but deeply scary.
He was a mediocre painter. He would not have been thought of as anything very special.
Barbara Rose is an art historian who was a friend of Warhol's early in his career.
It was his ability to not be judged on his native ability as a draftsman or as a painter. His ability to persuade people through these brilliant tactical maneuvers. I mean, he opened up everything so anybody could walk in. And Andy was very instrumental in destroying all standards. There are no more standards in art. None. I'm an artist because I say I'm an artist. You market, you get a PR agent, it's in the magazines, that's it. And he certainly is the pivotal figure in that.
Warhol had figured out that in a culture inundated with images, in magazines, newspapers, on TV, an artist could make a career off manipulating images without inventing anything. It didn't matter how skillfully he painted the can of soup. That's why he quickly moved from hand-painting each one to silkscreening, producing near copies in quantity. Warhol created thousands of Campbell's soup images. Even the people at the Warhol Foundation aren't sure how many there are. But that didn't devalue them. Repetition, not originality, was the source of their power.
And at that time in the 60s, you had all those gurus coming from India, you know, East, Midwest. And actually, if you go back to Buddhist, Buddha art, usually you just don't have a Buddha, or you have, you know, 20 Buddhas, and in the middle there's a big one. There's a Buddha painting with, I think, 365. So when Warhol did, for instance, 300 Coca-Cola bottle, it's sort of coming from there.
In other words, the soup cans and Coke bottles and dollar bills were like icons. Warhol recognized consumerism as the true American religion, and he would be its Michelangelo. He was the Michelangelo we deserved.
He said, well, the best museum really is Bloomingdale's. Well, what do you think the Museum of Modern Art is today? People don't go to museums to look at art. They go to museums to shop and go to the restaurants. It's all Bloomingdale's. Yeah, Andy really saw the future.
Barbara Rose thinks Warhol was a cynic who just painted things that stupid people would take for art. But most people who knew Warhol agree that he genuinely loved fame. And the Campbell soup can was as famous as the movie stills of Marilyn and Elvis he was painting, and about as substantial.
I think he first of all imagined that there was nothing inside the can. I think that he could face that nothingness the way he faced death when he was nearly killed, and the way he faced his own enigmas and his own loneliness. So I think he was really content to know that there was nothing in that can. No meaning, no significance, just a simulacrum of love or being taken care of.
In the mid-1980s, Warhol did a series of Campbell's soup boxes, mixes for instant chicken noodle soup, that kind of thing. It was only a year or two before he died, and by that time, Campbell's just looked like a pure nostalgia item. I don't believe that Andy was just a social commentator, or just a cynic, or just gay. I think he really loved soup. For Studio 360, I'm David Krasnow.
I don't know. I used to have lunch with him a lot. I don't ever remember him eating Campbell's soup. He was, you know, very informed about nutrition. He wouldn't eat that crap.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and there's more on the soup cans and the other American icons we've explored on our website, studio360.org.